He said, didn't you hear it on the radio? He said that the mines is closing in June. And he near flopped on the floor.
We're like a phoenix. We have risen from the ashes. And we're getting bigger every day.
His livelihood was gone, and he never crawled after that. He was so sick with all.
I never again will go down.
We're very proud of who we were, but I think it's fair to say that we're almost prouder of who we've become.
I'm standing about 300 feet underwater in an abandoned mining tunnel on Belle Island. Once one of the most important iron ore mines in the world, it's now slowly being taken back by the Atlantic. You can hear water drips echoing off the walls and the smell of salt from the encroaching sea. This place is forgotten, unknown to the rest of the world, abandoned. But it used to be vital to the lives of thousands of people in Newfoundland. From 1895 to 1966, Belle Island was one of the main suppliers of iron ore in the world. In its 71 years in operation, the men of Belle Island pulled over 78 million tons of ore from its depths. The iron was then shipped all over the world, to places like the United States, Belgium, and Germany. Belle Island was important, so much so that it was the only place in North America to be attacked by the Germans during World War II.
And you know the ironic thing about it? Between 1930 and 1939, the Germans were buying iron ore out of us by the shipload. So it's quite possible that the torpedoes that they used to torpedo our ore ships could have came from our iron ore, because they'd been buying out of us for years.
That's Brian. He works at the Belle Island Museum and Mine Tour in Wabana. The museum sits above the entrance of the No. 2 mine and is full of artifacts and old pictures of Belle Island's more prosperous days as a mining town before and after the war.
In the 50s here, it was paradise. For a person like me, it was paradise.
That's Gordon Skeynes. He used to work as an electrician in the mines as a young man. I like to think of him as this light bearer, returning a bit of brightness to the mine's depths.
When I went underground, I was about 20, thereabouts.
Gordon is in his 80s now, and he's one of the last people left on Belle Island who used to work on the mines. I recently met up with him to try and get a better understanding of what it was like underground.
Was I scared? The first time I went down there was when I was doing my apprenticeship. And scary, yes, because we walked in over the level, and they were drilling holes in the ceiling, and the fear was that any time at all, this may come down on you sort of thing.
Like all Belle Islanders, Gordon knew how dangerous the mines could be. Accidents happened every day, and over 100 men died in cave-ins or explosions. The men painted white crosses on the walls where their friends had died. These were eerie reminders of the dangers of the job. And if that wasn't bad enough, there was also the fear of the ever-present darkness. So, how dark was it down there? Because I know it was your job to bring the light, so I'm assuming when you would go down there to fix things, lights would be burnt out.
I can't explain it. If you close your eyes and think of being in a situation where it's dead cam, you can't hear anything, you can't see anything, it's just silent. That's the way it is underground. It's eerie, to be truthful. Yeah.
I had the chance to tour the mines this fall, and everything that Gordon said rang true. The darkness that you experience down there is suffocating. It feels like you've been swallowed by the earth, and you become aware of how tiny and delicate you are. This can be a very powerful and humbling experience.
And when you go on the tour here at No. 2 Mine, I always feel that you get a sense of the sacred. To me, and I'm a churchgoer, but to me it's almost akin to walking into a church. You can almost feel around you the sense of the people who work there.
That's Teresita McCarthy. She's a founding member and manager of the Belle Island Mine Tour and Museum. Like most people on the island, she comes from a long line of miners.
I can remember my dad coming home, and he would wash up out in the porch and take off his ori clothes, and then he'd come in. His hands, you could still see some more, but for the most part his hands and face were washed before he sat to the dinner table.
Her father rarely talked about what it was like in the mines. And so these red ori stains on his hands were the closest thing that Teresita got to understanding what life was like for the men of her island.
And if you talk to a lot of people who are families of miners, you'll probably get the same story. They didn't tell a whole lot about their work.
Because Teresita was a woman, she was never allowed in the mines. And so it wasn't until she was working at the museum that she actually got to experience what it was like underground. She shared a story with me about the first time she took her mother into the mines, which I think really captures what an emotional and eye-opening experience the mine tour was for the women of the community.
And I got her to the top of the slope. She started to cry. And I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "We're not supposed to be here. Women are not supposed to be in the mine."
According to superstition, a woman's presence underground foreshadowed an accident, and so they were forbidden from entering the mines.
But I cajoled her and got her to come along. So she walked down the slope and took part in the play and cried all the way down, cried all the way back. So I finally got her back into the museum, and I said, "What is wrong?" And she said, "I did not know." And I said, "You did not know what?" She said, "I did not know what my father did and your father did so we could live."
Mining was physically and emotionally draining work, but it was also the only industry on the island, and so people were tied to it. And for a while, Belle Island prospered.
Growing up on Belle Island was extraordinary. There were 13 schools. There were houses as far as the eye could see. There was between 12 and 14,000 people who lived in this small community. We hardly had to go into St. John's because every single thing that you needed was on Belle Island.
It was fine right up until we heard the news.
That news was at the mines. The only industry on the island would be closing for good. This came as a shock to many people who depended on them to survive. Gordon was competing in a curling match with his friend Harold Gazine when he first heard that the mines would be closing. He told me how a man walked up to Harold at the match and broke the news to him.
He said, "I suppose you heard news." He said, "Heard what news?" He said, "Didn't you hear it on the radio that the mines is closing in June?" And he near flopped on the floor. Harold Gazine had a trucking business. He was bringing a lot of equipment here from St. John's for the company. So when the company was closed, that meant his livelihood was gone. And he never curled after that. He was so sick of it all.
The closure of the mines devastated the island. It made them into a welfare town and led to a pattern of out-migration that would leave the island nearly empty.
The community itself was affected tremendously. A lot of people were working from paycheck to paycheck. And the people who could and had to make an effort to go somewhere else and get work.
Gordon knew that he would be okay. He was an electrician and had a lot more opportunity to work in St. John's and the surrounding areas. But most Belle Islanders weren't as lucky.
So there was a great out-migration. Government gave people $1,500 for their homes and sold them back to people for a dollar, with the proviso that you had to tear it down. You could not live in that home. So houses were being torn down exponentially, and people were moving in droves. And then there was about 5,000 people who stayed.
The people who had decided to stay had a very hard life ahead of them. For about 30 years, Belle Island was considered a welfare town. But these people were committed to keeping their community alive.
So, you know, we might have been faltering, but we didn't die. And I say to people, you know, we are still here. After 50 years, Belle Island is still a vibrant town.
And then in 1995, things started to look up for Belle Island. A group of Belle Islanders, including Teresita, had the idea to open up a museum at the site of the mines.
By 1997, we had received enough funding to build this building, which is the new museum, and to annex to number 2 mine. And we haven't looked back. We haven't looked back.
After decades of hardship, the source of their demise ended up being their savior. Today, people from all over the world come to Belle Island to learn about its history and for a chance to tour the mines that the men of Belle Island toiled away in for so many years.
So, for about 45 minutes now to an hour, we are going to step back in time and we will walk in the footsteps of the miners.
We see, on the average, between 10 and 13,000 people in the space of 4 months at this facility.
The tourism draw from the mines started to have a ripple effect on the economy. It brought tourists in who would visit the restaurants, hotels, and stores on the island. And slowly, Belle Island has started to grow again. Today, Belle Island feels like a sleepy outport. The community is still small, but there's a sense of new life and hope on the island for the future.
We're like a phoenix. We have risen from the ashes, and we're getting bigger every day. So, yes, it was hard. Yes, there was a dark period. But because of the Museum of Mine Tour, and because of the people who were willing to commute on the ferry, we have been able to grow. And we continue to grow. We're very proud of who we were, but I think it's fair to say that we're almost prouder of who we've become.
I'm correspondent Rebecca Nolan, reporting from Belle Island, Newfoundland, where we've been learning about the creation of the Belle Island Museum and Mine Tour.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. Our associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR.